Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And good morning, Rabbit.
Yeah, you got about half a rabbit today. Sorry, listeners, but fortunately I don't think you can catch this cold over the airwaves.
Yeah, well, you're doing much better.
And you can't do it over the internet, that's for sure.
Honey and lemon juice, that's very
honey and lemon juice and chamomile tea, that's the secret. We'll see if it works. That's what the doctor said. He said, don't bother to come and see me, this is what you do.
Yes, well, I'm sure this is not very interesting for our listeners.
Well, it's not, no.
So what's on the agenda for today's program?
Well, today we have Jacina Bullock Prado. We're doing a little celebrity snooping today because this is Jacina has a rather famous sister called Sandra, and she was famous in her own right until she decided enough of all that. And here's the rest of the story.
When I first saw the name Jacina Bullock hyphen Prado, I thought you were going to be some academic person.
with somehow connection to a famous art museum in Spain.
Yes.
I'm allowed to go in and take whatever I like.
But anyhow, you wrote a book called Confections of a Closet Master Baker, which I thought was very clever as a title. In fact, I just recommended it to somebody with a book called Forking Fantastic.
Tells you how much I know. I thought it said Confessions. I must remember to clean my glasses.
So it's subtitled One Woman's Sweet Journey from Unhappy Hollywood Executive to Contented Country Baker. And I thought, again, mistakenly, that people protest too much about their dull life in the spotlight. But as I was reading your book, I remembered that I had the same sense of phoniness growing up, because I grew up in an entertainment family, too.
Yeah.
Now, I guess we should mention the connection. Your mother was an opera singer, German,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And your sister is actress Sandra Bullock.
That she is.
And your father, now, what did he did something also. What was...
Well, he was a renowned voice teacher, and first he worked in the Pentagon, but he was a singer himself.
Oh, that was
the... And so he was a voice teacher.
Oh,
so
that adds up. And I didn't know why your mother, an opera singer from Germany, would marry somebody from the South who has worked at the Pentagon.
Yes. Well, she was his secretary. There you go.
Oh, there we go.
Well, that's been known to happen before.
Tell us why you wrote this book.
Well, I moved to Vermont after I got the heck out of Los Angeles to be a baker and a writer. Both. And when I opened up the shop, I had no time to write anymore. And many people would email me and come into our little pastry place and ask how I did it. How did I manage to leave a job that many people would die for?
You explained it, when you actually sit down to read this book and you explained all the stuff going on in your Hollywood executive capacity, it really sounded unpleasant.
I think I really admire the people who handle it well, who play well in the confines of something that can be very deadening to your soul, and the people who live really fulfilling lives and are good humans. And I really had trouble disingenuous quality of people, and I had the very singular task of having a company with a woman who was wanted by everybody. And everybody knew that she and I held each other in such high regard that they felt like they could somehow bribe me into her good graces. Little did they know that she and I are both don't kid a kidder kind of people, that we knew quite well what they were getting at, so no one got very far,
Not
even if they sent us sweets.
Yeah, I mean, you're very straightforward, right out front, and you also, you found a perfect marriage partner, right?
Oh, I really did. I can't imagine having been able to do it without him, since he's so supportive and he likes to eat. So we had the two working gangbusters.
So you picked up, you ditched this job, but you, in the process, though, you had been learning, you'd been working, baking, and you found out the pleasures. Explain what you said about the pleasures of baking.
Well, I think there's so many levels to it. I grew up with a culture of Germany and this kind of coffee time at 3 p.m. and really enjoying that culture of beautiful cakes and pastries and enjoying them. And then coming to America and getting a whiff of an Oreo was another kind of heaven. And so I grew up loving to eat the sweets, and my mother was a fabulous baker, so I could really appreciate the work that went into it. And as I got more and more unhappy, I went to baking as my go-to therapy of feeling better and fulfilled. And it was something, it turned out that I was very good at it, and I really loved doing it, and I felt incredibly productive. And
I love the story, though, about the apple pie and the board meeting.
Well, it's true. I mean, I would think all the time of what I'd make next and what makes things good and how I'd want to practice. And I really looked at baking as a storytelling, and people thought I was a complete... I would get after meetings talking about romantic comedies, instead of the script, somebody once sent me a Martha Stewart baking book. And I was like, this has really gone too far.
So why Vermont?
Well, Vermont is a gorgeous place. It's full of very creative, lovely people. But
especially in the food industry, huh?
Yeah, and, you know, the food industry is amazing here. We have small farms. We have people that are very, very conscientious about what they're putting into their mouths and eating local food. So that was lovely. And people have a very good sense of what's tasty. And they bought my treats. But my husband went to Dartmouth, which is right around the corner from where we live, and I had never been to the Northeast until he took me here, and I went, oh, this is it. I didn't know until now that this place existed, and I realized it was home.
Wow. So you're happily ensconced there. Do you know a lot of these food people in Vermont? Because I always want to have, we've interviewed so many of them, I want to have a big party. Somebody has a party space. I can't remember which.
I think it's Crescent Dragon Wagon.
Are you sure it's Crescent?
I think so. I think you told me that.
Well, I'm not sure it is, but anyhow, she inherited a house, this, whoever it is, who has an on-purpose party space. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to get all of these people spread out around the state for a party? Wouldn't that be good, a Vermont party?
A Vermont party would be, I imagine the food and the fun, and there would be a hell of a lot of drinking.
Well.
No, they have to import that. No.
Oh, no. Considering our cold winters, the fact that people are drunk 24/7 is, I think, pretty much a miracle.
It's a little bit like northern Sweden in Vermont. Huh?
But, yes, I think without quite as much depression and a little more sunlight, but yes.
Okay, let's catch up then with this story again. So you gradually realized that baking was where your heart and soul was.
Yes.
And you managed to also convince your husband? Is that the deal?
Well, he didn't take too much convincing. I mean, he works in the industry as well, and he's actually in China right now working on a film. But the whole atmosphere was toxic for the both of us, and he's a painter as well. He's an illustrator. And he and I both looked at it as an opportunity to really find our best selves, to be the good, productive people that we knew we could be, and not let LA get to us anymore and make us nastier and crabbier and less productive humans. We wanted to do it right. We had found each other. That was a good part. Now we wanted to get the second part right.
Yeah, because you said you were born a misanthrope.
Yes.
That's hard to believe.
Well, in social situations, I'm a bit of a lost cause. He's great. He's a far more social person than I. So we have a great partnership there too. So yeah, I've always been terribly shy, a bit misanthropic, but that's why baking kind of worked for me, in that I was in the kitchen baking, and that's the way I showed my affection for people, because I not so good at it the other way around.
Yeah, you write about the story of having the one-way glass in front of the pastry kitchen so you can see people and they can't see you.
Exactly.
And maybe they're interrogating Sandra Bullock on the inside, or maybe not. You have a story about the good cop and the bad cop.
Yeah.
This is a mini life story as well, punctuated.
Well, I did that so purposely, thinking that, no, this is really the way I can check to see what's going on in the shop, but still have my anonymity and my privacy. But, you know, when you see those good cop, bad shop shows, when you're sitting in the dark, it's perfect because the person on the other side can't see you, but we clearly have to have light to bake. So you can to some degree see inside that space where I'm baking, but it looks like a ghostly figure. So people try even harder to look in the space because they know they see something. They're just not quite sure what.
Okay. Well, but the another important thing to remember, aside from a fascinating life story, is it's punctuated with wonderful pastry recipes.
That are doable.
And stories to go along with them that explain not just the recipe, but why they're important. I think it's a fascinating story. I can't wait for the next installment. Is there going to be one?
There is. I'm already well into it, which is exciting, because I really love to share I love to share the stories and the food behind them, and then know that people are getting closer to their kitchens and to their traditions. I think it would be quite a shame to lose our family traditions and food, and that's one of the reasons I love writing about it.
Now, for those people who actually are in Vermont but actually never heard of you, perhaps you'd like to just reference where you're located so people can find you, and then do you have a website that people can access as well?
I have a blog. It's Gesine, G-E-S-I-N-E.com. And the shop in Montpelier, it's no longer running because we are currently renovating a tavern in a small town near Quincy, Vermont, so that I can have a commercial kitchen there.
So you're in transition right now?
I'm in transition, yeah.
There you go. Well, you might let us know so that we can share the information with our listening audience across the globe once you're open again. This Quigi name, I came across that somewhere. Is there a restaurant and a farm products business?
Yeah, Simon Pierce, the famous glass blowers, and they've got a gorgeous restaurant there.
Okay, I think there was another one with an association with someone who's making bacon and salumi, but I can't remember. I'll have to look it up. The name of the town is so weird it rings a bell.
Yeah, it's a great town.
Okay, and any other information that you'd like to convey and leave with our listeners?
Well, I am always at anyone's disposal for baking emergencies. I have people emailing me through my blog, and I have such a kindred spirit with people who love baking but are having trouble, like when you get into those awful spots where something's exploded. I usually respond almost immediately because I don't want people to feel that they're going to have to stop baking because they've had a disaster in their kitchen and then they should never try it again. I think that's the best way to learn how to be a great baker is make mistakes. So I really enjoy people kind of visiting the blog and asking questions about what they've done wrong and trying to find old recipes that maybe their grandmother made and they can't quite figure out what it was or find the recipe, and I'd love to do that kind of research as well.
Well, I have some recipes for you from my grandmother, which calls for things like a jar of jelly.
I love it. Some of the strangest things crop up now and again.
Well, that's to make 144 dozen Gucciadani.
Gucciadani, right. Now, tell us your blog spot address.
Again.
You can go to www.gesine.com or confectionsofamasterbaker.blogspot.com.
Well, it was so much fun.
Always fun talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.
Yeah. So, and good luck to you. I'm so enjoyed that you're happy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how can you not be happy when you're baking?
Well, maybe
I don't bake. Maybe that's what I need to do.
Maybe this summer we'll get to Vermont. We didn't make it last year. We didn't make it the year before. Maybe this will be the Vermont.
Where's Michael's house?
I don't remember.
Anyhow, we have a friend who's always inviting us. He has a house there.
So. You have to take him up on his offer.
Okay, and we'll have our party.
Yeah, we'll have a big party.
Oh, great. Pet that dog that's circling you. Okay, Gesine, thank you so much, and keep us posted.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And now I think it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And what do we say now about this time?
Oh, we say keep in touch with us electronically. If you'd like, we've made it possible for you to do that right from the main page of our website. Ann likes Twitter. Peter likes blogs, so maybe. Ann does Facebook. And you can even click a button and just send us an email. So we love to hear from you.
Old-fashioned, isn't it?
Well, we're old-fashioned, but we're also as up-to-date as in Kansas City. Everything's up-to-date in Kansas City. I never really understood why they said that. But everything's up to date at On the Menu Radio, and we're on for our next program.
Yeah, what's up
segment.
Next?
We have an old friend of yours called Paula Wolfert, who's just written a fabulous book called Clay Pot Cooking, and I make names up for all the tracks and when we record them, and this one's called Clay Pot Paula, which sounds like a good name to describe the next segment. So why don't we listen to what Paula had to say.
I'm totally amazed, or I was totally amazed, to realize that in our 6 years of broadcasting, we had not had an interview with Paula Wolford. She's a grand dame in the best of senses in the cookbook industry, and as crowned, she was crowned queen of Mediterranean cooking, was it? By the Los Angeles Times?
I guess so.
Yeah, and it says right here in the jacket cover.
Then it
queen
must,
of Mediterranean
don't
cooking.
You read on jacket.
then it must be true. Now, listeners, you also have to bear in mind, Paula is saying that the Sonoma Valley has given her a bad cold. That's not my excuse. I'm not in the Sonoma Valley. I'm sitting in Pittsburgh, where it's kind of damp and cold and miserable. So there are two out of three of us are not sounding as at our best, but Paula swore she would do the best she could.
Well, the Sonoma people tell me it's allergies. It's not a cold.
Oh, okay.
I see. You must be allergic to grapes or something, which is a terrible thing to be in the Sonoma Valley.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I guess they're picking all around you right now, aren't they?
Yes. The vines are heavy.
Yeah, we were in Oregon a couple of weeks ago, and they were just starting their harvest there.
Yeah, but it was early this year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They even said that about California.
It's been a very crazy year. Our tomatoes were late.
You know, tomatoes were wiped out by blight in those places. Not ours, thank heavens.
Yeah, we're too dumb in the garden to have such a sophisticated thing as blight. Now,
you sound like so much fun.
Now, I'm worried about this book.
Why?
Now, let me explain why I'm worried about this book. Because you quote somebody from France who says that the only thing you should ever cook in is a clay pot. You shouldn't cook in aluminum. You shouldn't cook in metal pots.
Yeah,
I see. Okay.
I wondered what you were getting at.
Well, you have to read these books. See?
Yeah, I read that comment, but that was a long time ago.
No, it wasn't 19th century. It was 1927.
1927.
And it was adorable. And
besides, he was a Frenchman, so he can't trust anything he says.
Well, let me tell you something. That's a really interesting thing that you mentioned that, because I checked out that person. That person doesn't exist.
Is that right?
Well, let me tell you. A French novelist, Marcel Tignara. I never heard of that novelist. It turns out it's really a woman. But in those days, back in the 1920s in France, it was hard to get published. So this woman wrote under a male name.
Oh, yeah, but that was common.
George Eliot did exactly that a century
right.
before.
Yeah.
So I was just looking through some old books and there, and some little pamphlets, actually. It was in a pamphlet called Le France Autobre. And I read that, and I said, oh, that's just delicious.
Yeah, well, I read it.
Let's read the note, because no one else, I mean, your listeners aren't going to hear it.
Well, see, when I read that in your book, I thought to myself, she must be really well read, because this is the most obscure quote I've ever heard.
Let me read it, because it's only one paragraph.
Go ahead.
Everybody was caught up. Finally, this is the last two paragraphs of the introduction. Finally, I can't resist quoting from 19th century French novelist Marcel Tignard, who wrote in the anthology La France à Table about the dish Seps in the old style of the Périgord. So she writes, now reveal her as a woman. Take an earthenware casserole that we call in the Périgord a poêlon. If you don't have one, use a thick copper casserole. But frankly, nothing is as good as clay for all sorts of slow-simmered dishes. The clay maintains even heat and doesn't brutalize all the good things you entrust to it. Never cook in iron, enamel, or aluminum. These are the works of the devil.
Yeah.
And on that delicious note, I rested my case.
Yes.
Well, just in case you're wondering, listeners, why we're going on about clay pots, it's because Paula's latest book is
Mediterranean Clay Pot Cooking, Traditional and Modern Recipes to Savor and Share. Now, I think we need to point out, we didn't do that in the introduction, that Paula, you have written how many, seven other cookbooks, and you are such an expert on Mediterranean cuisine in general, and you've won every award imaginable. So you keep plowing on here. Now this one, we find out you've been collecting clay pots since you were, was it 18 or 19?
19.
And of course, that was just about a decade or so ago. It's really amazing
right.
Somebody's managed to write seven books in a decade. But this is an absolutely complete book. I mean, if we started cooking from this book now, how many years would it be before we had to find another cook? That was the question. How many years would it be before we'd have to try another cookbook?
Actually, on Facebook, we have a little clay pot group, and some of them have now started to cook their way through the book.
Oh,
and join with them.
Well, presumably,
I guess like Julia, everybody's doing.
Well,
that.
I guess everybody is been injected with that.
Okay,
I knew Julia Child, and the funny thing is that she drank me under the table.
I know that. I understand that.
She did that with quite a number of people.
Yeah, she was very friendly with some friends of ours, the Jamisons, who raised Lamb.
We miss her all. We all do miss her.
Oh yeah, but now we were going around today, looking around to see what clay pots we had.
What do you have?
Well, we have no unglazed one.
Okay.
I realized that there's one.
I'm not so prejudiced. Unglazed.
And then I realized that my favorite one, as some others, in fact, that in a picture, clay, were broken. And that's, I don't understand how you can maintain them without breaking them all the time.
Well, that's the one problem. And that's why they should remain cheap, and most clay pots are cheap, is that sooner or later, they do break. People drop them, but I have never broken a clay pot.
It sounds like you haven't.
And I have over 100.
Wow, amazing.
But I know to be careful, and I know the rules. The rules are you don't add something cold to a hot pot,
mm-hmm.
and you don't put a hot pot on a cold plate.
Right.
And those two, if you have those two things, usually nothing happens. But what it brings to the taste of food.
And explain some of your ideas about that. I mean,
it's very healthy. But let's start at the beginning. Truth is that clay pot cooking is different from other cooking methods. It really is. And if you're a health conscious person, it's lower fat. It's full of, brings off fish and vegetables and beans better than metal does. And these are the foods that people are encouraging you to eat. And one other thing that no one ever mentions is that you can bring it right to the table from the stove.
Now you have to be careful to put it on something, right?
Yes, of course, but I just said that. But there are drawbacks. As you said, it can crack. But that probably was a poorly made pot, I hate to tell you. Mm-hmm. Unless you dropped it.
I actually knocked it off of shelf. My chicken. I'm talking about my chicken one in particular, which was a professional pot. The other ones actually were made by craftspeople, so they could have been poorly made.
We do have a red Emil Henry ceramic pot.
Yeah, does that count?
And,
wait, is it flame top or is it the one that goes in the oven?
It can do either one. I cook with it on top of the stove,
when
and I also.
If you cook it with it on top of the stove, it's wonderful. Flameware is new clay, and that is what you don't have to worry about putting it on a cold place when coming out of a hot oven.
Yeah, you told a story about that.
But that is really flame top. I don't know if you're using an old Amy Longry.
No, this is
not very old. And that you talk in your book about somebody who developed this technique for this flameware or whatever.
Well, it's been. I'm not the only person doing this. Nigella Larson in England now has a line of flameware. Flameware is hot. I mean, aside from the fact that it gets hot.
Yes.
But clay pot cooking is, I think, is going to be adapted. It fits right in with being locavore and healthy foods. But flameware has a different mix of clay, and it's baked to a very, very high degree, so it's very strong. And there's a number of people in the United States, starting in the 40s at Vermont, who started playing with it. And do you know what it has in it? It has lithium.
Lithium?
No
in
kidding.
The clay. No, it doesn't. It won't do anything to your personality. But
yeah,
it does have lithium.
All my bipolar friends take lithium.
Well, they ought to start cooking. No,
exactly.
It won't affect their personality. But it just happens to be in the clay in the clay mix. Very strong, but if the diffusion of heat is so beautiful that it coddles the food. Now you remember that really, except for something like sautéing, high heat sautéing, most food benefits from slow cook.
Right,
and that's where if you want fork tender and buttery, soft textured food. I mean, clay is the way to go, but clay is much more than that. My book is about all the different ways that people in the Mediterranean have kept alive certain dishes in clay. So even though a risotto is always better cooked in clay, I only give one recipe for risotto because I have to move on to all the other things that are done around the Mediterranean that I want to show the spectrum. It's incredible. And you only need maybe five pots, and five pots will cost you the same as one staub.
Okay, and what you're saying is there are, even in clay pots, there are different styles that
are
more suitable for different kinds of cooking.
Yes, because there's different kind of clay and they do different things. But I'm particularly fond of bottom-up cooking, which is what you're doing by cooking your using your Amy Henry on top of the stove.
Uh-huh.
Because when you, unlike a crock pot, which has heat on three sides, when you have the heat coming from the bottom, you're able to develop certain amount of caramelization slowly. So you're extracting flavor and developing it and infusing it back into the meat slowly. And then finally you start a braise or a stew. And there's all kinds of things that I point out in the book. We'd have to spend 5 hours.
I know. Well, you have almost a spirituality in, when you're talking about these pots.
Well, just like all those religious people, you know, you can't tell them anything.
So you pray to a, so you certainly pray to a clay god every morning. Huh?
Now, a lot of people have.
Now, it seemed to me that in addition to the five different, if you like, styles of pot, you also have, I detect at least three different ways of clay pot cooking that theme through your book. What, one of them is you basically put the stuff in and you put the lid on the pot.
Right.
The second one, it's so important that things go uninterrupted that you seal the top of the pot with dough so you don't get any air coming in from the outside. And then you've got a third style where the cooking, the pot is actually open.
Yes.
You leave the lid off.
Yes, it looked like the cazuelas in Spain.
Now, did I get that right? So
well, there's more, actually more, because there's also the clay environment.
Go ahead.
Which is putting two most people have a pizza stone in their oven. If they put a second pizza stone in their oven on the top shelf, they would create a make-believe fire brick oven.
Okay.
Which, when you bake things, you know, you can take your stoneware, which you can't put on top of the stove, and make your gratins. If you, after you've cooked your gratin in the oven, turn off the heat and leave the gratin in for another half hour to bake in the receding heat, which is held firm by the two slabs, you will get a glazing that you never got before from an ordinary oven.
Isn't that amazing?
That in the old days, that's why people brought things to the oven. One, they didn't have ovens in their home. But two, they honored what they brought back, the old gratin dauphinoise, or whatever they brought back from the oven, from the communal ovens, had this beautiful, beautiful glaze on it. People, you know, say, why can't I do that in the home? You can't do it in the home unless you create a clay environment.
Okay,
and so the book talks about that. Why do certain things stay alive? And then once what you can do, it's amazing how you can improve your cooking.
And you know, Peter had one worry. If you imply that if you cook the same thing over and over again in the same pot, the pot remembers and basically, I think you're implying that something remains in the pot.
Sure.
And he wanted to know why it didn't spoil.
Yeah, why is
well,
it?
Well, because, you know, it's funny. You have a man right in your town. I asked him about
that. Oh, Bob Wolk.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a friend of our chef's.
Okay. Now, he gave me a quote, which unfortunately my publishers, I think, took it out. Because they said, oh, my God, Paula, you can't say this.
Really?
He said it. But it basically, he said, what are you worried about? It's going to be heated. Any germs will get killed.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I see.
Well, that's what I thought.
Well, Bob's quite a character. We know him, and
I've traveled with him.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
I adore him, and I adore his wife. I mean, they are fabulous. Yes.
Well, anyway, let's slide back to this book here, because we can't afford to go through it all on the air. But you cover absolutely everything.
I tried.
You tried. Okay, well, what did you leave out?
Well, you know, you constantly learn, and I learned about poaching in clay. I haven't thought about that before, but actually, if you poach in metal, your pan, like a cast iron pan, if you poach, let's say, a piece of fish in either aluminum or cast iron or anything, there is a swing of 8 degrees. Which means you're really not poaching some of the time. Some of the time you're actually almost boiling. But with clay, you only have a swing of about 1 or 2 degrees.
You mean in terms of
the steady heat.
Okay, I got you.
The desired, when you get to a desired temperature, there's a cycling of heat. Things keep getting, and metal keeps getting hotter and hotter. But clay evens off once you have your adjustment of what you want. I mean, your adjustment of the fire. Or the temperature, the swings of temperature. And that was something I hadn't really known about when I wrote. I mean, that came afterward. But I thought that was interesting. I mean, it's endless.
I realize
that's a very minute thing, but it just shows that there is there's a difference in the way things cook.
Now, there would have been, I think, clay cooking in Asia, too, wouldn't there?
Yes, but I can't be all things to all people.
No.
I can only do what I know about. And I can write about it. And I have my sources. And people always know about the Asians using clay pots. They've forgotten that you can't go to southern Spain and have a rice dish, except for the paella, which, of course, is done outdoors, without it being cooked in clay. No one would think of it. And a good housewife in Italy would never make a risotto, except in an umidiera, a clay pot. And in Morocco, good cooks still cook their tagine.
Oh, yeah.
In clay. Well, actually, a lot of them have switched over to pressure cookers because now their work...
Oh, please, don't tell me the worst risotto. Somebody sold me on cooking a risotto in a pressure cooker. It was probably the worst risotto I've ever had in my life.
Would have been very good for hanging wallpaper.
Oh, it was terrible.
That's, you know, that's interesting because Lorna Sass wrote a book on cooking in the pressure cooker, and she became very famous for her risottos.
I know. Well,
her 7-minute risotto.
There are people I know who are risotto experts that use the pressure cooker.
Yeah.
I gave mine to my hairdresser, cooker.
we only did it once.
We
don't cook risotto that often. That was something that we really needed to keep. I have one last question because it's probably in the book and I just didn't see it.
But
if I'm a convert, where am I going to go buy the clay pots that I need? Assuming that Sur La Table and Williams-Sonoma and places like that are all that are at my disposal, am I going to be able to get what I'm looking for?
The very first all clay pot top of the stove ware shop opened in this town, and I didn't know the people, and they didn't know I lived here.
Oh, wow. Who is it?
And it opened, because I have a website, and I'll give it to you in a minute. 6 months ago, they opened, and when I walked in there, I in my best Bogart accent, I said, of all the gin joints in this town, you walked into mine?
That's funny.
It's called BramCookware.com. He's an Egyptian. She's an American pharmacist turned cook, a clay pot lover. And they sell Italian clay pots. They sell the micaceous clay pots from Colombia. They sell some beautiful, strong Turkish and Egyptian pots, and they have an assortment. So they have something online, Bram Cookware. Then there's Clay Coyote, who has wonderful flameware at half the price of that other company.
Okay, yeah, we won't mention which other company that is, but that's okay.
ClayCoyote.com, and then, of course, for the Cazuelas, there's either Tienda.com or SpanishTable.com. With those four addresses, five addresses, you have everything. Oh, you don't have the Chinese sand pot at $9 a clip. That you have to go to an Asian shop. Now, you can get Chinese sand pot, which is dirt cheap in the stores, but online, because of the, I don't know why, it costs a lot more.
I guess they're probably heavy.
No, I don't, you know what, they I don't know why. But the Colombian micaceous clay is fabulous.
That's what I understand, yes.
And that's at Bram Cookware. Go to their site, look, you'll see. And then also La Tienda and Spanish Table, coyote.com. You have everything.
Yeah,
and coyote.com also has some Chilean unglazed pots, too, which are very strong. So they don't just do Mediterranean, but they're interested in stovetop cooking, and they're beautiful things.
Well, this is a wonderful thing, and then of course to go along with that, you have to have this book called Mediterranean Clay Pot Cooking.
And the recipes themselves are so wonderful. It's not just the concept of the clay pot.
Well, aren't you sweet? Thank you.
Oh, they're just
and also how to make your own vinegar, and then you can go to claycoyote.com and get your crock.
Well, we're going to be in clay pot cooking heaven pretty soon because it's going to be cold. So this is just exactly the kinds of things we're going to need. And Paula, I'm sure you've got another project in the works. And
I'm working on my Moroccan, updating my Moroccan cookbook.
Oh.
So it'll be more tagines.
I love
Moroccan.
more tagines than you can poke a stick at, as I say.
Well, tagine cooking is a whole other story.
Yeah.
Don't forget to call me when it comes out.
Well, you can be in touch with us, Paula. Was a delight
to
talk
to
you.
Thank you so much for inviting me onto your show.
Oh, really, it's been fun. It's great meeting you.
And reliving these moments.
Yeah, maybe we'll touch down on Sonoma again soon. We were just there, weren't we, Robin?
Robin, the Bram cookware shop is right on the square.
Okay.
It was amazing.
That was the square I got lost in.
Yeah, that was the
place. We're not going to talk about that.
Well, that's a story for another day. I thought I had lost the love of my life in Sonoma. It's not that big a place, but now she has a cowbell on, so she doesn't get lost.
Paula, like an adorable couple.
Paula,
say hello to the walkies for me.
I will. Yeah.
Paula, have a great day, and I hope soon you get over the cold.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paula. Bye-bye.
I was so excited and stimulated. I made chili the next night in my clay pot. Well, it's not exactly a clay pot.
It is.
But it's the Emile Ari pot, which Paula said was just fine, and the chili was delicious.
I'm so sorry. I broke that chicken, though. Chicken clay pot. It used to sit there looking at me, and then I knocked it over accidentally.
Oh, dear, dear, dear.
Dear. Maybe dear, a chicken, too.
Your voice is fading. You're so sad.
Anyhow, it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
As always, here we are again, and we're rolling into our last segment for the program, and There are two books. One is about Asian dumplings, and the other takes a broader view of the whole entire Silk Road. But do you realize, by the way, that all of our guests on today's program are women?
I never noticed.
That's not how you put the program together, huh?
It's not how I put the program together. No, I put an Eastern program together. I put Jacina because I thought it was such a fascinating story. Mm-hmm. And the same with Paula Wolford, who seems to me to be making a major contribution with her book. So anyway, for the rest of today's program, you're thinking Oriental, and you're thinking how you can go about, first of all, learning how simple it is. I'm not sure I entirely believe that, to make Asian dumplings of all different kinds, and then to understand the origins of cooking along the Silk Road, which happens to cross parts of the same continent. So it's a fascinating 25 minutes or so. I'm sure you'll enjoy, and we'll come back to you at the end of the program.
Andrea Nguyen has been a guest on the menu before, and I want to welcome you back, Andrea.
Thank you so very much, Anne.
I was so confident that this was going to be another beautiful book that I think I pre-ordered it ages ago.
Well, I appreciate your support.
Yeah, and as I told you, it's all over Twitter. People who admire your writing respect it and were really anxiously awaiting this book.
Yes, they sure have. I think that people are very excited about making these kinds of foods at home and tackling them and finding that they're not as difficult as they think they may be.
Now, we were talking about the fact that I've never once, although I love Asian dumplings, never made even a single one of any variety. And I feel, after looking at the illustrations and the photographs in this book, that in fact I might even be able to tackle it.
I think you can, Anne. You know, I try to tell people that this is not rocket science. It's really homey food. It's food that people have been making for ages. And what I try to do in my work is to really demystify some of these concepts. And so much of what we can do with making Asian dumplings, just like wontons, pot stickers, the ingredients are right at your fingertips. And the neat thing about the book is that I try to inspire people to prepare the dough from scratch. And you can do that, make pot stickers from scratch from beginning to end with just regular all-purpose flour that you get from the supermarket. And if you're willing to use a pasta machine to roll out your own pasta, by God, you can make the most ethereal wonton skins.
That might be the only reason I can think of.
Because that works on the assumption that you have a pastor make it a rule of out, which this household doesn't have presently, but that doesn't mean, of course, that we couldn't do something about it. Now, I have a more simple question. How did you get to become such an expert in the first place?
Yeah, I wanted to say that, too. I wanted to ask about, like, tell us all about your background, your other writing, and so forth.
Sure. I have been a good eater since I was very young. Let me put it that way.
So that's a good start, right?
Yeah, that's a very promising start. And my parents exposed me to a lot of different kinds of foods, and I was very curious about different flavors and textures.
You see, I was a good eater. The trouble is my wife is a great cook. My mother was a terrible cook, so I'm glad I didn't learn anything from her. So anyway, back to the story.
Well, my mother was a very good cook, and she was quite the disciplinarian. She was also a curious cook who just didn't try to master just Vietnamese food, but also dishes that she saw, Chinese dishes, French stuff, American stuff, and we tried to make them at home. And because we had a very large family, we couldn't afford to go out to eat all the time. So, you know, we would do things at home. We would also read cookbooks. When I first arrived in the United States, started learning English, and by the time I became relatively proficient, by around the fourth grade or so, I started going to the library and checking out cookbooks to read, as if other kids would read novels, for example. I would read cookbooks cover to cover. I'm self-taught. I've cooked professionally in restaurant kitchens, but I really am in sort of the geek side of things with regard to doing research and trying to be more, I describe myself as a professional home cook, and just to try to like figure out, well, can I do this at home, and can I make it so that other people are willing to try these kinds of recipes that they may otherwise think is left to, you know, some kind of ancient, arcane tradition. And I tinker around in the kitchen. I really enjoy that, and I enjoy sharing the information and techniques with other people.
Now, what kind of, do you need special cooking pots?
No, not really. You know, a lot of these dumpling recipes can be prepared. If you've got a food processor, by all means, let that machine do its magical work for you, or you can make the doughs by hand. You perhaps need a Chinese steamer if you want to steam your dumplings.
And for rolling
out certain kinds of dumpling skins, I say, please get a little wooden dowel rolling pin, which is nothing but really a 12-inch long, 3/4-inch thick wooden dowel that you can get cut from your home improvement store if you want to, and sand it down.
Yeah, no, you know, I don't know if we actually mentioned the title of the book. It's called Asian Dumplings, and then the subtitle is Mastering Gyoza, Spring Rolls, Samosas, and More.
What's a gyoza? Come on.
Gyoza is the Japanese word for pot sticker.
Okay, all right. So it's a pot. So even though they're categorized as slightly different things like pot stickers and spring rolls and dumplings, they're really all dumplings.
Yes. They go by different names depending on their shape and stuff and how they're translated from the original language that they belong. They're all dumplings.
Well, I didn't know, actually, because I've never seen them all collected in one book, that there were so many varieties. I mean, what countries do you touch on?
I touch a lot on China, and then discuss how the Chinese concept for something like a little pot sticker radiates to parts of East Asia. So we're talking Japan and Korea and down to Vietnam. And then from Vietnam, there's also Southeast Asia, Thailand, the Philippines, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia. And then we go into South Asia, which it covers India. And then from India, there's Tibet, Nepal, and I touch even on Mongolia. But Asia is very vast, as the same goes with Asian dumplings. So really, sort of reining in the definition of Asia and also developing a tight definition of dumplings itself was certainly a task that I had to tackle at the beginning of the book.
So a samosa, an Indian samosa, is another version of the same thing.
So it is certainly, I categorize it as a dumpling because it is something that is wrapped in dough. It has a filling. It is a morsel of some sort that you could eat out of hand. And so in that regard, yes, it is a dumpling. What we think of as a dumpling in the West, for example, chicken and dumplings or a apple dumpling. So how, or some people even call a ravioli a dumpling. So our definition of dumpling in the Western construct is kind of also kind of problematic too, because how do you rein that in, right? And so I had to also apply that to Asian dumplings as well. And in the end, I define it as things that are wrapped in dough, things that are wrapped in leaves, things that can be actually involve a batter that's coating the filling, things that are simply just a thick batter that you would drop into oil, or you could even say that you could poach a dumpling, because it's hard. In Asian terms, we really don't have something that says dumpling. If you were to look up the terms in Asian language, we don't have dumpling as a definition, as a word. We have dough stuff sometimes. It's doughy food. And who doesn't love carbs, right?
No, exactly. Isn't that? I'm just reading through the list of, you do have, by the way, a section that gives all the essential ingredients and equipment, and you do go through all the different cooking techniques. So it really demystifies that section, too, for the average cook.
It does, yeah. Steaming is something that is done a lot, and there has been a lot of talk and discussion in cookbooks of how you should get the bamboo steamer and, for example, put it into a wok. I don't do that because it takes away the beautiful patina that I've worked so long to get on my wok. So I will actually sometimes I'll take a perforated pizza pan or a Chinese, what's called a steamer rag. It's nothing but a metal piece of a utensil. It's a metal tool that's just a flat sheet with holes in it. So holes sort of like the size of large peas. So a perforated pizza pan is sort of similar. They're sort of like small tapioca ball shaped, those holes. But you put it over a Dutch oven, any okay. size where all of the holes will be covered, and then you set your steamer on top of that. What that allows you to do is steam with a lot of water underneath so that you do not have to refill that pot so often. And it generates just the right amount of steam heat, and it works absolutely beautifully. Of course, you can also use one of those metal steamer if you want to. And then with regard to frying, you know what? I love fried food, and I try to get people to abandon their fear of frying.
Yeah, I mean, that's a skill. I know some people are natural friers. I am not. Peter is very good. He makes wonderful fried potatoes.
Anne's a nervous fryer because she's worried about all the calories in the oil. I tell her the secret is you have to have enough.
That's right.
It is possible to have too much, but that's unlikely. It's certainly very possible to have too little, and then everything sticks and you don't get the desired result.
Exactly. And if you fry with enough oil, it is, and at the right temperature, the food comes out very clean tasting and not greasy.
Right. Now, just some of these examples, just recipes so that people get a sense of the huge scope of this. Now, you have like Filipino shrimp, meat, and vegetable spring rolls called lumpia, huh?
Yes, yes.
Then you have, let's see, what else? Shanghai spring roll skins. You have, oh, those are getting into, of course, the wontons. You have different kinds of wontons. You cover steamed sticky rice dumplings with shrimp and pork, which looks absolutely heavenly. And it says that you vegetarians will find a lot to deal with in this book, too.
Yes, vegetarians, people who are gluten-free, there is a lot of people, the vegan recipes are wonderful as well.
How could you do gluten-free? What do you use instead?
Well, gluten-free would be like the sticky rice dumplings you just talked about.
Okay.
Yeah, you're steering away from wheat, right?
Yeah.
So rice is fine.
Exactly. Tapioca is fine. Rice is fine. Potato is fine.
This looks good. Spiced pineapple filled pastries.
Oh my goodness, those are to die for.
I'm curious also, you said you included Mongolia. Our nephew just married a Mongolian woman.
Oh.
I call her the Mongolian princess. She's very, very smart and gorgeous. She's a doctor, an MD. And her parents could not make the wedding in Cornwall in England. So they're going to redo it in Mongolia next year.
Oh, my.
We're honestly not certain if we're going to go. Anne doesn't like the idea of there being no such thing as a fixed building with a fixed bathroom.
Yes, well, there are the yurts.
Yeah. Yes, our nephew's father-in-law gave him his own yurt.
Yes, well, that would be quite an experience if you do go. I believe there's a movie called Mongol, and it's about Genghis Khan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I told you Genghis Khan was
right.
from Mongolia. That's why at one time it was so powerful, and then it became a whole lot less powerful, and I'm not just exactly sure what its status is right now, but if we're thinking about going, I guess we better find out.
Well, what kind of dumplings do they make?
They make a lot of wonderful dumplings called kushur.
Spelled
K-H-U-S-H-U-U-R, and they're oftentimes deep-fried, and they're filled with lots of meat that is very simply flavored, but also quite wonderful. The filling that I have in the book involves caraway seeds, which is one of the few spices that grow well in the Mongolian climate. And it lends a wonderful sweetness to the meat, and it's just absolutely wonderful. It's simple food, you know, and it's food for people who are on the move constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a food that also lends to the notion of, like, dumplings can be survival food, too, you know, in that sense.
Yeah, well, I think our nephew ought to do pretty well with that because he was raised in Cornwall, which has pasties.
Yeah, so,
oh,
I mean,
goodness.
After all, a dumpling is just a mini... It's just a mini Cornish pasty, or a Cornish pasty is a dumpling on steroids.
That's right.
And it has some mystery substance in the middle. Of course, there are no mystery substances in the Asian Dumplings book because everything's spelled out. And I think it opens up a whole new vista. Maybe I'll have to get the tools and I'll have to launch into a career as a dumpling maker.
I think you are particularly well poised for it.
I don't know why you say that. I don't need Anne is quickly saying I don't need to be encouraged. Please don't make such suggestions. But we'll give it a whirl. This is obviously the must-have book for those people who would want to begin or end, or I guess easily enough you could have a whole meal of Asian dumplings. So dumpling eaters across the world and about to be dumpling eaters should be grateful, and thank you so much for joining us and having the chance to talk to you about this today.
Andrea, thank you so very much.
I always love talking to you, Andrea. Keep in touch.
Okay, I will. Thank you so
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Laura Kelly has written a book called The Silk Road Gourmet. I should add, however, that we're looking only at volume one of it, and there are going to be two more volumes. Laura, welcome to the show. I don't know where you find the time to do a three-volume piece.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Tell our listeners the scope of your book. Volume 1 encompasses what?
Volume 1 is Western and Southern Asia.
Okay.
And it runs from the Republic of Georgia to Sri Lanka. And I try to look at the patterns of food that are in the commonalities between countries and then connect those commonalities in the food with historical events, whether they're trade or economic relationships or shared religion or empire.
So you're in fact suggesting that there was an anthropological basis and a geographical basis for the similarities in the cuisine along the way.
Absolutely.
Oh, of course.
In fact, some of it was quite purposeful. When you have, this is a topic that will be covered in Volume 2, but you had Timur, when he was building his great Uzbek kingdom, he was purposely bringing in the greatest artisans from all over his kingdom to try to bolster the international reputation of his city. And these were the greatest thinkers, and they were bringing their cultures with them, including their food.
Well, so what about Peter the Great? I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
Peter the Great,
yeah,
didn't he do the same thing?
But he wasn't exactly on the Silk Road. I mean, the Silk Road was Silk Road was a sort of bigger thing because it extended over several centuries, and trade went both ways, right?
Yes. In fact, the roots of the Silk Road go back as far as 4,000 years ago or more, 4,000 BC, actually. There's an episodic trade of the lapis lazuli and jade between Afghanistan and China.
Huh, lapis, huh?
Huh?
Lapis, great.
Yes, the Afghanis have great lapis, in fact.
Oh, wonderful.
And the Chinese have great jade, and that's where it all started. And interestingly, in our history books, we only consider a small portion of the Silk Road, that is the Central Asian overland route from China to Europe, when in fact there were many, many land routes and also sea routes that connected the world from Europe to China and the Philippines and Indonesia, Thailand, India, down to Mogadishu, in fact, even in Africa. So,
wow.
And the North African area of the Mediterranean was included. So you have this incredible engine of commerce that's moving cultures and ideas around. And it's really quite remarkable to...
Well, what gave you the idea to do this ambitious project of three-volume Silk Road Gourmet Book?
Well, from a taste point of view, I found that it was kind of difficult to come up with really authentic recipes in the United States sometimes, that a lot of them had been toned down or adapted because ingredients used to be difficult to get. But with the internet, a lot of ingredients have become available. You can mail order everything from lemongrass to holy basil these days, or if you're lucky enough to have a market.
Now, you were talking about the availability of ingredients and so on.
Right.
But what drives the market? I mean, why did you think that this was something you needed to write?
It's also to get the authentic flavors out there and to show people that, you know, a lot of ingredients had been edited out, when olive oil put in, for instance, for light sesame oil, or chilies, the amount of chilies toned down to the point where it hardly resembles the authentic dish. So it was a part of the idea to get an authentic book out there, to update some other concepts to the 21st century now that we have internet commerce. And lastly, it was to give myself a creative expression from my day job.
Is there a family connection? Is there a...
I come from
this particular region?
Foodie.
Yes, you do.
Every Italian family is a family of foodies.
Oh, okay, so you're not from Georgia or Armenia or any of the places along the road.
But I did grow up in the kitchen, because that's just what...
Absolutely.
I know that, too. I actually had a really interesting conversation. Lydia Bastianich wrote that Italian-American cookbook. I don't know if you ever saw it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a conversation with her, and she was able to tell me the exact ingredients that were absolutely substituted by Italian Americans for the real stuff. I mean, what
mm-hmm.
the real stuff was in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course you would be. I mean, was there an area of study? I mean, I guess she made herself an expert on it, even if she wasn't.
Well, I mean, but she's
Just like Laura made herself an expert on the countries along the Silk Road.
Yep, by traveling through them.
you were traveling there for other reasons besides...
Working in public health or for other employers.
So, and you cook these recipes too?
Yes. I've been cooking since I've been about 13. Part of that is family, and part of that is just my mother used to throw these wonderful international parties in the backyard, and this is back in the 70s and things like that, when it was really hard to do this, like an Indonesian night or something, with torches and all sorts of food. And I grew up like that. My sister actually became a professional chef and used to direct the Morrison Clark Inn down here in D.C., as well as working on the line for Daniel Boulot. And she started as entremetier and wound up as poissonnière at the original Daniel's before she went on for greener pastures.
We know that restaurant very well. Which of these in Volume 1 recipes were you really surprised to discover a variation in what people were expecting? Or have things people were cooking, and in fact they were far removed from the original recipe?
I would probably say that some of the biggest surprises were actually in the Georgian and Armenian recipes, that there was a lot of toning down that was being done to the spices. Georgians like their food fairly spicy, or rather what they do what many Asian cuisines strive for is a variety of different flavors, sweet, salty, hot,
mm-hmm.
you know, that sort of thing. So they'll have this incredible pepper sauce named adjika, that they put on meat, and then they'll put a semi-sweet pomegranate and sweet basil sauce on it.
Wow, that's unusual.
So it's a really complex, it winds up being a very complex dish with, a wide variety of flavors as it moves through the mouth. So it's, I think that was probably some of the biggest surprises, is how flavorful the Caucasian and Caspian food was.
Well, it'd be interesting. We went to a Georgian banquet in Pittsburgh, given by a friend who had just traveled there and came back. And the thing I remember most about it was everybody drinking themselves into a coma. Yeah.
Well, I guess they do that. I guess they do that too.
Well, I just went to a tasting, wine tasting at the embassy here in D.C. That was really fantastic. They had
from Georgia.
Yes.
Wow.
They had several different vintners there, and vineyards represented, and so you could walk through and taste a traditional wine that's done in the beeswax-lined clay amphora in the ground.
Yeah, we visited a winery in...
In fact, he's buying his amphoras from Georgia.
From Georgia, which I thought was an odd...
He's a winemaker on the...
Grosvenor.
On the border of...
Friuli
of Italy, Friuli Venezia Giulia, and I always forget the name of the country that's on the other side. Slovenia, I think. So, but he found out about this practice.
He buries them in the ground. I mean, he tore up
his... I'm sure they do the same thing.
Yeah. Georgians do exactly the same thing, in fact. And they stir it with these long wooden rods, and just so, and it's really quite a remarkable process. And then you could walk to the other side of the room and have the vineyards who were going at the same wine, same grapes, with a more modern process. So you really got a sense of how it had evolved from traditional wines to today. So
that's interesting.
Talk to us a little bit about the food in Afghanistan. It seems to be in the news right now, and food is not one of the things it's in the news for.
Well, Afghanistan is really a special case. It's very interesting because it was a real crossroads between East and West throughout its history, and it's been almost ruled, is what I'll say, by a lot of different cultures.
Oh, everybody's been there, yeah.
But nobody's ever really ruled it.
Correct. Yeah. Nobody's ever really. There's always been revolt that's fomenting in the mountains.
That's like Sicily.
Meanwhile, all of this political change has left a large cultural marks on Afghani cooking. So it's really quite remarkable. You'll get some very, very Western type spices in there, like thyme and basil, even though that's really some from the Indian subcontinent. And then you'll get some real Eastern flavors coming in. So it's quite interesting. And there's all sorts of surprises, like they have these tamarind ginger potatoes.
That sounds great.
Would really go good, really go, we eat them here, matched with a great steak or a lamb chop or something like that. So you don't have to just experience the food in the Silk Road Gourmet, just saying we're going to eat Afghani tonight. You can incorporate the recipes more globalized presentation.
And all these ingredients are readily available, right?
But now they are, yes.
Yeah.
And our area, we live in sort of the Baltimore, D.C. corridor, and we have a Persian market nearby, we have an Indian market nearby, and we also have an East Asian market. So I'm within half an hour of almost anything. And there's some rarer things, like some Caucasian ingredients that I can get through the mail seasonally.
Tell me about Mongolia.
When you say Caucasian, in this case, you're talking Georgia in the Caucasus.
Georgia and Armenia, yes.
You're not talking about white Americans.
No. I can get some Georgian and Armenian things, rarer things that are harder to get, like Janjoli or the fresh sour plums. You can get the dried sour plums in a lot of different markets, but to get them fresh, that's still a little bit hard to come by, or fresh sour cherries. You can mail away for those.
Now, our nephew just married a Mongolian, and I saw some photographs that they took when they were on their honeymoon there in Mongolia, and the food did not look very appetizing. The one arresting image was of the head of a goat floating in a pot of stew.
Like a Rolling Stones cover from the 60s.
I guess. Now, how would you suggest that readers would use the Silk Road Gourmet in their daily cooking? Is it something for special occasions, or you want people buy into the whole thing?
I think it's something to be enjoyed every day. I mean, it's really quite catching on with a couple of English chefs who are incorporating a lot of the recipes into some of their restaurants. And
could you mention those?
Well, I'll say the chef's name. The menu consultant is Miles Collins. Okay. And he's on the web, and he blogs about this stuff all the time. But he's put quite a few of he's put some koftas and some lamb recipes, and as things become more seasonally available, he can source them fresh. He's going to be doing some vegetable accompaniments and things. He says, I can't get pomegranates yet, so I haven't put the rest of your dishes in. Mm. But here in D.C., I'm working with a restaurant called Me and You. It's a Pan-Asian. It already had the Pan-Asian concept, but I'm working with them. They'll be cooking some exclusive wine dinners based on the book.
Oh, great.
Send us a notice. And yeah, we'll post it. The first
one will be Georgia. And we're going to have all Georgian wines. I've done a suggested menu and suggested pairings for them.
See, now, I wouldn't mind coming if I didn't have to drink that brandy and juggle, knock that thing down over, empty over my head.
I promise you, you won't have to, but you may enjoy some incredible Mukwezani and some Trishi, some of the other lovely wines.
Well, Laura, if you'll send us information about that, listeners will be sure to put the information up on the website and under OTM News so that you can keep up with that if you'd like to. And what's the projected availability of book two?
Book two, I hope, will be in the summertime of next year. I hope to be able to get it all done. But going back to your question about how people should use this, I have two suggestions. If you let's say you know you like beets or you know you like lamb chops or something like that, go for some of the flavor combinations that seem a little foreign. That's one way to incorporate it into daily life. A lot of the recipes, if you have a basic familiarity with the ingredients and have the ingredients on hand, or 15 to 20 minutes, maybe a half an hour, really, really quite quick. I'm a working mom, and I cook this. So I cook it after a long, you know, coming home from a long day of work. So it's doable that way. Another way you could go about it, and something I like to do a lot, is tastings, where you all get together and between five or six friends, you'll cook a Nigiri meal, each one of you bringing one thing. Or you can, say, take all of the stuffed peppers from Georgia to Sri Lanka or something like that, or stuffed vegetables, and bring them and try them and then talk about the flavors and talk about how one is different from the other. And it's more of a master class, I suppose, approach to using the book.
Well, I'll tell you, listeners, there are some exciting things that you would never have thought about in here, such as lamb and rhubarb stew, baked fish with pomegranates and oranges. I mean, this is exciting stuff. So,
a lot of meat and fruit combinations.
Yeah, I'd like to try it. Well, anyhow, Laura, keep us posted and send us a note about the dinner.
Okay.
And great talking to you.
Yeah, we'll talk to you next year about Volume 2.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me.
Thanks, Laura.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.
Well, that wraps it again for another week, and I'm going to say until next week.
Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.